today. I call your attention this morning to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 2. The title of the message today is 6 Miles from Christmas. 6 Miles from Christmas. Israel is not a big country. Israel is a relatively small country. If you were to go from the saying that you have grown up with, and you've heard me say it 50 times, if you were to go from Dan to Beersheba, what that means is that in Dan, that is in the northernmost part, which was like a border area, all the way down to the tip of the southern area called Beersheba. We would pronounce it Beersheba, but the B's are in the Slavic language are Beersheba. It's only 150 miles. I mean, that's like driving to Macon and back. You can be in one part of the country in the morning, see three or four things, and by the evening, you're in another part of the country. You can travel up within 100 miles of Jerusalem, and almost every major event that has taken place in the Bible has happened in that geographical region. The passage that we're going to look at today is no different, except that it's not within 100 miles, it's within 6 miles. I want you to think with me for just a moment about 6 miles. Even I can go 6 miles on my feet. Now, it may take me longer than it would take many of you. Many, many moons ago, my wife said, "I've got something I want you to do for me for Valentine's Day." And she said, "Will you do it?" And I said, "Well, what is it? I don't want to tell you what it is. I just want you to do it. If you love me, you'll do that." You know, that's one of the things you women put on us, you know. So I said, "Okay, I'll do it." She said, "I want you to walk around Stone Mountain with me." And I thought, can't be that hard. So that morning, we met the Cherries. I've never forgotten that, and I've never forgiven them that either. So Joey and Alicia were out there. Me and Deb were out there. And we started. And I said, "Are we about done?" And she goes, "We haven't even gone a mile yet." And we kept walking and walking and walking. And I thought, I need to stop. I need to sit down somewhere. Why don't y'all keep walking and get the car and come get me? But after a while, I finally made it. All 5 miles of it. And can I tell you that I could not do it today as quickly as I did then? But I could still get it done. Now, I may have to stop, you know, sit on a curb for a little while. May have to drink a couple of bottles of water. But I bet I could do it in a day. I might take me a nap by one of the big old pine trees out there. But I could do it if it was that important. I want you to think about this. You've got our passage here when it says that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Bethlehem is 6 miles from Jerusalem. When you see that he was born in Bethlehem, you also notice that the next two words, it says, of Judah. Why is that important? Because there were other Bethlehems. It's just like many of the states in our United States, they have different names of towns that are in their state, but the towns share the same name. There is an Athens, Greece, which is another country. There's an Athens, Alabama. There's an Athens, Georgia. I think there's an Athens, Tennessee. You've got Athens all over the place. And so, you have more than one Bethlehem. There's actually two during the time of Jesus. You had the one that was in Judah. This is what is referenced here when it says Bethlehem of Judea. That's Judah, the tribal geographical land for Judah. The other one was in the tribe of Zebulun's land. And so you've got Jesus being born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. That's important. How many of you, when you think of the birth of Jesus, you think of the year one? Was Jesus born in the year one? How many of you? Raise your hand. What about the year zero? Okay. Some of you already know this then. Or else you're just a bunch of gutless wonders and won't make a guess. All right? Herod the Great, which is the Herod referenced here, died about 4 BC. If Jesus was born, as it says here in verse number 1, Jesus was not born in the year 0 or the year 1. He was born about 4 or 5 BC. And so you say, well, how come our calendar is messed up? Well, you can thank either Gregorian, which is Pope Gregory, or you can thank Julius Caesar. The Julian calendar. You can thank one of those two guys. So anyway, you've got Jesus being born during the time of Herod the Great. But I want you to notice when it says, behold. I want you to look at this. There came wise men from the east to Jerusalem. What did they say? Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen a star in the east and are come to worship him. And when Herod heard these things, remember now, Herod is king. And you've got these wise men that come, and they come in the front door. I mean, they are riding right into Jerusalem, and they're saying, where's the king of the Jews? Now, let me tell you something. If you've never done a study on Herod the Great, he was a lunatic. He killed his own kids. He killed a wife. You say, why did he do that? Because he felt as though they were undermining him. So he just had them killed. And so it was not a real big deal for him to try to be, you know, a little trickster. Use a little subterfuge. And so when these men come riding into town, what you have is you've got Herod, and he calls them and he says, basically, he said, these guys are asking all of these questions. So he gets his wise men, when it comes to religious affairs, to come to his palace. In verse number 3, it says, when he hears these things, he's troubled. Jerusalem's troubled with him. And when he gathers the chief priests and the scribes, these are the religious leaders. These are the guys that are the top in the spiritual world in Judaism. And so he begins to just ask them questions. He demands of them where Christ should be born. And in verse 5, they say unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For this is written by the prophet. And of course, we know what that prophet is. It's Micah. 5th chapter, 2nd verse. And so as we look at the first few verses here, there's some questions. Who are these wise men? Well, it comes from a Greek word. We would say, in English, we would say magi. Who are these guys? Well, I don't think anybody really knows exactly. There are people that that think that maybe this group of wise men began in Persia, and maybe their first teacher was Daniel the prophet. They think that possibly Daniel, who lived a little over 500 years before Christ, he was an old man when the Medes and the Persians took him into their empire after they conquered the Babylonians when he was a young man. But they think that maybe these men got their start with some teaching from Daniel. Maybe that's why they recognized that this star was a little different. There's other people, and they say these guys were astronomers. They would study the stars. And when they studied the stars, they would make notes. And they, all of a sudden, they noticed that there's something that is unique about one particular star that hasn't been there before. And so, whether it was something that began with Daniel or something that was an astrologer that was in the ancient times, we know that God was involved in this. And so, we see that the magi are wise men. And may I say that wise men still seek him, as the bumper sticker says? So where did they come from? What does it mean when it says they came from the east? What it means is that they probably came from one of two places. I personally think it was Persia, which is where Daniel was at. But there's some good people that think that it was from Arabia. So whether it was Persia, whether it was Arabia, that's no big deal for me. Let me just tell you what is a big deal. They travel thousands of miles, right? You travel over 1,000 miles to get somewhere, you're serious about getting there, right? You know, we can get on an airplane today, and we can go 630 miles an hour. You know, and in a couple hours, by the time you take off and land, you've gone 1,000 miles. But it wasn't that way 2,000 years ago. You imagine yourself riding on a camel. Imagine yourself having to go through the desert. Imagine yourself searching to make sure that your water supply stays full. All the time, you've got rumors going all over the place. These guys have got all kind of money with them. You say, well, how do you know they had money? Because of the gifts that they gave. You have gold, you have frankincense, and you have myrrh. And I won't digress and go into the meaning of all of those things from a symbolic standpoint. But just suffice to say is, these men were traveling with money. My sister works for a man. This happened several years ago. And she told me about it after it had happened. And the man is very wealthy, very wealthy. He may be the most wealthy guy that I know. I don't know a lot, but I know him. He had a home at one time in Scotland. Had a home at Sea Island, down outside of Brunswick. Had a home in Texas. He had a home in Massachusetts. They would just leave vehicles at all of them. They would leave clothes at all of them. And if they decided to go somewhere, they'd just get on a plane and just leave the clothes at this house. And they'd have maids come in. And yard guys come in, and they'd cut the grass, clean the gutters, wash the clothes, new bed linens, so that the next time they decided to come into town, it'd all be ready. I can't even fathom that. Right? You know, I mean, I think that I'm traveling light whenever I get a Kroger bag and put an extra pair of overalls in it and go see my mama. Right? And so, this fella, now he's got a little lady that's about 4'10", and she's the driver. His wife is as old as he was. And at this time, they were in their upper 70s when this took place. They left Massachusetts, drove down to Sea Island with $1.2 million in gold bullion in the trunk of the car. And it was like, why did you do that? He goes, well, I wasn't about to carry it on an airplane and have them confiscate it. And all I'm thinking is, you got a 4'10" driver. She's not exactly going to be whipping somebody. You got two old people. If somebody would have found that out, they didn't. They even spent a couple of nights on the road. I don't know if they drug the suitcases in at night or what they did. But I'm just telling you, these guys were traveling with bucks. But can I tell you that when they traveled, they probably had an escort? That's why if you look back at our passage and you see it says all Jerusalem was troubled, some people are thinking, we got an army that's coming and these guys are spying it out. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking to find the King of the Jews because they have been taught. And they see this star and they say, don't matter where how far we got to go, we are going to find him. All right? Not only that, what I just did. Okay? How far did they travel? 1,000 miles. How many were there? How many of you know the song, We Three Kings of Orient Are, bearing gifts we travel afar? All righty? You don't know that there's three. The Scriptures doesn't tell us that there are three. And not only that, it doesn't even tell us that they were kings. There's a passage over in, I think, in Isaiah that alludes to the fact that they could possibly be kings, but it may be that they were just representatives of kings. And so we don't really know. Tradition many years ago used to say 12. They whittled it down to 3, possibly, I guess, for the Christmas programs at churches. It's a lot easier to get 3 wise men somewhere than it is 12. Right? And so how many, we don't really know. How did the star lead them? You know, most of the time, stars are fixed. So that's why I think that this was a unique star. I think it was unique in the fact that it appeared. It was unique in the fact that it stayed where they could see it every night. They saw it and they could travel in the direction that it seemed to be leading them. And so you say, well, do you think it could have been possibly, you know, where a couple of the planets aligned? Could have been Halley's Comet? All of those things have been speculated on. The only thing I know is this. They said, we have seen his star in the east. And so, you have men that were stargazers. But now, they're following one specific star, and they're traveling over 1,000 miles to get to where it's leading them. And so, we've got that question. And then, why did they call Jesus King of the Jews? They didn't know Jesus by name. Can I tell you that I think that God put that in their heart? I think that possibly the teaching that they had received from men like Daniel. Can I tell you that they probably understood that Messiah would be King of the Jews. And so they're seeing the star. They're traveling 1,000+ miles. And they finally get there. And what are they doing? They're saying, there's the king. When these men walk in, you don't find them receiving anything except a smile from the face of the baby. Maybe a handshake from Joseph. They don't get anything in return. But yet you've got these men and they're bringing in gifts. They're bringing in gold. They're bringing in frankincense. And they're bringing in myrrh. We don't know if it was 3 chests or if it was 3 gifts and it had different quantities. We do not know. But we do know this. Those men traveled a long way to give things to Jesus, and they got really nothing in return except knowing that the struggle and the distance and the things that they've had to endure was all worth it. Now, at the time of the wise men, Jesus is not a baby really anymore. We would call him a baby. But in reality, Jesus is about 2 years old at this reading. Now, the first group of people to see the baby Jesus were the shepherds. That's the night that he was born. You can go to Israel, and just outside of Bethlehem, they have what is called the shepherd's field. And you can see where this sheep were grazing all over. And they would have little caves that they would use to keep the livestock in. And it could have very easily been one of those little caves that the baby Jesus was born in. We've walked in some of those caves. We've seen the sheep grazing in the distance. And it's just outside of Bethlehem. And so you've got these wise men. And they are just loving the fact that they have gotten the chance to see this little baby boy. And you say, well, how do you know he's not in a manger at this time? Look at verse 11. When they were coming to the house. So they're in a house now. They're not in a manger. So that's how we know that. And that's why we say that Jesus is about 2 at this time. But there's another question. Why didn't the Jewish leaders go to Bethlehem? You had wise men that traveled 1,000+ miles. But you had men that supposedly were steeped in the Scripture. And I think they were. But they wouldn't walk from here to Snellville to see the Messiah, which is what their whole deal's about. If you're a religious leader, you're supposed to be looking for Messiah. You're supposed to be wanting the Christ to come and set up his kingdom. That's what you're supposed to want. Every Jewish family, if they had a daughter, they wanted their daughter to be the one that gave birth to the Messiah. They desired that. Why wouldn't they walk? Why wouldn't they get on a camel? Why would not they get on a horse to go see Messiah, which their whole life was supposed to revolve around? I think this morning that there are probably 3 things. First of all, I think that they were sleepy with prophecy. You say, now, preacher, what do you mean by sleepy with prophecy? I think that there are times when God gives us prophecies and it's just kind of like it's a glaze over. When I preach sometime on the second coming of Christ and we have people that talk about, do you really believe that the rapture will take place? You know, I've been hearing that for 40 years. You really believe that? Can I tell you that if we're not careful, we'll begin to glaze over with that truth? The Apostle Paul was looking for Jesus in his time. You've got other great Christians down through the centuries, and they were looking for Christ in their time. I'm looking for Christ in my time. But if I'm not careful, I'm just not thinking really about the coming of the Lord. I'm thinking, well, one of these days I'm going to die. one of these days I'm not going to be here any longer. And I just kind of glaze over with the prophecies. But can I tell you that there's twice as many prophecies for Jesus coming back as there were for him to come the first time? But yet we just kind of glaze it over. These guys knew prophecy. They knew that there was going to be a Messiah that was born of the seed of the woman, Genesis 3. They knew that he was going to come through the son of Noah that was named Shem. They knew that he was going to come from the tribe of Judah through the line of David. They knew that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob would be in that early lineage. They had all of this. They knew that a virgin was going to give birth. You say, where does that come from? Isaiah chapter 7. But can I tell you that they even knew the very city, the little small town, old little town of Bethlehem? Look with me at verse number 5. And they, the religious leaders, said unto him, Herod, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah. In other words, it was just like the most country town that you can imagine in the area. I don't even know how to describe it. Think about the worst place that you would never want to live, that was close by to where you did live. Right? That's the way they felt about Bethlehem. When you look at commentaries and when you listen to preachers and they've gone back into the cultural archives, so to speak, nobody really thought much about Bethlehem because it was a bunch of sheep herders. I mean, we could say Hicksville. You know, do you want to hang out in Bethlehem? No, a bunch of hicks out there. But yet, they knew exactly. And he said, you're the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. They knew the prophecy, but they just glazed over with it. Just glazed over with it. Not only that, but they were severed in their practice. What do you mean by that? Have you ever heard the term useless knowledge? Well, what good is that? I don't know. I heard a discussion between two guys the other day, and one of them told me, said, you know, they told me one of these days, whenever I got out of high school, that I was probably going to use that trigonometry. They lied. He said, I've never used trigonometry that I know of a day in my life. And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe you just don't know. But there are some things that you can know that is just absolutely really useless. Right? Did you guys know that okra is part of the cotton family? Now, that don't mean that you want to quit eating okra and start eating cotton balls. But they're in the same family. There's all kind of useless knowledge. It's almost like we get 8 or 10 of us together and we say, let's play a little Bible trivia. I mean, let's just see if we can know these facts about the Bible. You know, we'll say something like this, you know, see if you can name the 12 tribes. Who was Paul's helpers on the second missionary journey? And you got all of these things, and everybody just kind of thinks, well, what good is this going to do? Well, in reality, there's times when we know things that don't help at all because they were not put into practice. They were not put into practice. One of the things that I used to do when I was a youth director, I came across a list of 100 things every Christian ought to know. It was developed by a friend of mine named Carl Dobson. Carl was a plumber. He lived over in Decatur. He never married. But what he did, he had a ministry to a bunch of teenagers. And every Monday or Tuesday night, he would have a Bible study. And he would invite these young people to come. And it was mainly a bunch of guys. It was usually about 75% guys, 25% girls. And he would teach them a Bible study on Monday or Tuesday night. And the way that he would get those guys to be interested was at his house where he lived on his mom's property. His dad had already passed. He set up some batting cages. And these baseball players would just go over to Carl's house, and he had some other guys there. If he was working plumbing or whatever, they would just basically let them have access to the pitching machines. And he developed a list of 100 questions that every Christian ought to know. How were people saved in the Old Testament? That's a good one. Why was it important that Jesus resurrected? You ought to know some things like that. And if you want one of those lists, I still got the list. I still give them out from time to time. But if you get those 100 questions and you learn the answers to those things, you're going to have a working knowledge of the Bible like very few preachers have. But what I want you to understand is this. You can know the answer to all 100 of those questions. But if you don't practice them and put them into work and put them into some type of conversation with somebody, whether it be a teaching or a witnessing or whatever, what good is it? I mean, what good is it if we don't use what we know? These guys didn't. I mean, they knew about the patriarchs and the Messiah's coming through. They knew about the tribe of Judah and David and all of those things. They knew that. But they would not walk 6 miles to see the Messiah. And so they were severed in practice. Not only that, but I think a third thing is that I think they considered themselves to be self-important. I think that if you were able to talk to them, they would put their thumbs under their spiritual suspenders, so to speak, and they would say, "We're the chosen ones." Can I tell you that's still the attitude that many have today? Well, I'm just telling you right now, I just don't think that God, who's a God of love, I just don't think that He would let anybody go to hell. Well, what does the Bible say? I mean, you can believe all kinds of stuff. You can think, I'm the smartest guy in the room. But the criteria is, what does the Bible say? All you've got to do is just observe. And you can see people that are arrogant. You can see people that are lifted up with pride. You can see people that are all full of themselves. I mean, they're talking about my rights this and my rights that. And you've got people that are just simply, I mean, it's just all about them. And so, whenever you look at Bethlehem of Judea, at the time of Jesus, you've got about 200 people that live in that little town. You've got tens of thousands that are living in Jerusalem. They're the ones that are in, you know, the city. Have you ever noticed that sometimes city dwellers want to look down on pastors folk. Sometimes they do. I used to hear people criticize farmers. And every time I would hear a criticism on the radio or a television or read it in an article somewhere criticizing a farmer, all I'm thinking is, don't talk with your mouth full. You know? Don't talk with your mouth full. And so you and I, we can see this. If we know the Lord, we have some spiritual vision, unless we are sinful, out of fellowship, and now we're beginning to be blinded by our sin. But if we're in fellowship with God, we can see those types of things. But these Jewish leaders could not. And there are tens of thousands of people that do not see that they are lost today. They are self-important. Now, when I say those things and I read this story to you today, there's some takeaways that I want to give to you. First of all, can I tell you that everybody had the same information in the story? Everybody had the same information. You've got the Jewish people that had it. They were taught it from the time that they were children. You have Herod that received it. You had the wise men that received it. And so everybody's operating on the same basic truth that they all had the right information. And can I tell you that today, 2019, soon to be 2020, people are still without excuse. Romans chapter 1 says that they are without excuse. Second takeaway, it's possible to know some things and still miss the truth. Let that sink in. There are some things that we can say, man, that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But it doesn't have anything to do with truth. What does the Bible say? I beat that drum a lot. Because the Bible is our book. It is our guidebook. It is our blueprint. It is our standard of our faith and practice. It's what we use. If we don't have a Bible, this is the current social club. If we don't preach the Word of God, we're no different than a civic organization. And so, you've got people that know things, but they still miss the truth. And at the end of our 6 miles, you've got to ask your question, what have you done with Jesus? What have you done with Jesus? If any of you have ever heard me comment about the Kennedy family, you know that I'm not a huge fan of old man Joe Kennedy. He made his money in liquor during Prohibition. And somebody said that even today they still get like a nickel on every bottle of vodka that comes into America. He was married to a woman named Rose. And by her own testimony to a man named Jess Moody. Jess Moody was a preacher. And several decades ago, when Miss Kennedy was still alive, he related this in a book with her permission. By her own testimony, whenever they were first married, she was basically enamored with money and power. And how that if you had a lot of money, it seemed as though power came with that. And she said she was drawn toward it. She said, I was not a happy lady. And she said, then we had our first child. And when they had the first child, it was a girl. And they were so excited. But yet, quickly, they began to realize that there was something wrong with the child. wasn't long before there was, I guess, a diagnosis of mental retardation. And the little girl, all of her life, would be in an institution. And every week, old man Joe and Rose would go see the little girl. And she said, it seemed as though that every time I went, I was more and more angry. She said, I was mad with God. She said, on one particular night, we were to go to a social gathering. And she said, but it was weighing on my mind. And she said, I was upset. And I told my husband, I don't want to go. I'm not going. He said, I won't go either. That night, she was in a room, angry as she could be, and a lady that was a maid worked for them for a long time, several years. She looked at her and she said, Miss Kennedy, I've been observing you for the last several months, and I noticed that you are getting more and more angry over this situation. And she said, if you don't do something, it's going to ruin you. Why don't you just simply bow your head and say, oh Lord, make my heart a manger for Jesus. Rose Kennedy said it made her so upset, she fired the woman on the spot. And she said, I couldn't sleep that night. She said, I tossed and I was turning. And all I could think about is it kept rolling through my mind. Oh, Lord, make my heart a manger for Jesus. And finally she said, I rolled out of bed. I knelt beside the bed and I said that. And she said, Mr. Moody, I cannot explain it other than the fact that what you talked about tonight, about opening your heart to Jesus, I did it that night, and my life has been different since that moment. The anger left, and the love came in, and it's never gone away. You say, well, how did the story end? She got in touch with the lady that she had fired and hired her back, and that lady worked for the Kennedys until she died. When I heard that story, I couldn't get away from the fact that that maid had enough courage to say, why don't you open up your heart and let it be a manger for the baby Jesus? So this morning, I ask you, what's your heart like? Have you ever opened your heart and said this, dear Lord, I want you to come into my heart. I want to make it a manger for Jesus. If you've never done that, you've never lived. So this morning, ask yourself that question. 6 miles from Jesus, Christmas is Jesus. Christmas is all about Jesus. They had Jesus just up the road and would not respond. You've got Jesus here this morning. And if you've never met him, how will you respond? Let's stand together. About eyes closed. Now, dear Lord, I thank you for your word this morning. And I thank you that we can take that one question, why didn't they walk 6 miles to get to Christ? And Lord, that's a question that all unsaved people have to answer one day. And in reality, you're not 6 miles away. You're right there next to them, knocking on their heart's door, saying, let me in. So I pray today that if we have someone that does not know Christ, that they will simply, as Rose Kennedy did, open up her heart and say, my heart's a manger for you. Pray that they would come on this verse. We have those that just need to maybe spend a little time in prayer. Help them to come. Or if we have those that would like to become a part of this fellowship, may they come as well. As musicians begin to play, we come on this first verse. Pray as long as they need to. You may be seated just a moment. Let me mention two or three things. First of all, let me remind our guests, if you're here for the very first time or if you've never done this before, I want to ask you to go out the back doors when we dismiss, turn right, and the first door on the left, my wife and I will be there, and we have a little gift that we would like to give to you on behalf of the church, and I hope that you will do that just as soon as the service is over. Also, today is going to be a busy day for the cast and crew of the Christmas Express. They have practice today from 2 until 4. Then there's choir practice at 4, evening service at 5. And plus, the cast and crew need to, and choir need to make sure that you remember the practices this week. I think there's one on Thursday and one on Saturday. This is for everybody. If you're in the play, singing, whatever you're doing, you need to be a part of this. And if you're not there, it hinders everybody. I was watching that ball game yesterday and had a guy that threw a punch. And when he threw that punch, you know what that meant? That meant that he didn't get to play the first half next week. And because of that, that act of selfishness hurts the team next week. You are a part of something big. Next Sunday is big. And so let me encourage you to be here and be at those practices this week. Now, also this week, we've got a couple of other things. On Tuesday, I want to encourage those of you that can to be a part of this. Brother Don is going to be taking a group of people down to the Noonan area, and they're going to listen to Dr. Paul Chappell. Dr. Chappell is a pastor from California. Probably has 3,000 people in his church. His college has got close to 1,000 students. And he is going to be preaching in Noonan. And they're going to be leaving about 4:30. And so if you folks would like to go, you're welcome to. And that, you men can go. We've already got, I say we, I'm not going to go. I've got a class that night. But Brother Don's already got three or four guys that are going to go. Miss Melba's going. You ladies can go if you want to go. And you will not be disappointed listening to Paul Chappell. So you're going to be leaving about 4:30. It's about a two-hour ride. And I can promise you that you'll get you something to eat. Okay? So don't think you've got a pack of crackers or something. You'll get you something to eat. And so that's Tuesday. Then on Friday, we did this last Christmas, and we're doing it again this year. If you're a widow lady, you're invited to come to our home for a Christmas widow's luncheon. I think last year we had maybe 30 people that came. And so if you want to be a part of this, then you see Miss Janice Bennett. Now, one of the things we'll do is if you want to come to the church, we'll take the people mover and we'll drive you to the house, put you out right there at the back door, walk right in, not too difficult to get in and out. If it is difficult, we'll pick you up and carry you in. And it'll be fun. So you ladies, want you to be a part of that. If you're going to ride that bus, you've got to be here about 11:30, 11:35 at the latest. It takes about 20 minutes to get there, okay? Men too? All right. We've got widows and widowers. I think that's, isn't that right? Widowers. All right. Men and women. All right? So, we'll feed you somehow, okay? We'll put you on the back porch. All right, so anyway, men, let Miss Janice know that as well. Or let Deb know that as well, okay? Well, I think that's it. Let's stand. Thank you so much for being here. Now, next week, as I mentioned, is the Christmas Express. And I'm telling you, it's going to be fun. The last 2 years, the Christmas program, I think they're the two best back-to-back years we have ever had. And I'm looking forward to this year being the trifecta, okay? Well, tonight at 5 o'clock, I'll be preaching from 2 Samuel 11. David's headed for trouble. God bless you. We'll see you this afternoon.